Information about the world of running, inspiration to fuel passion and excellence, and ideas for making connections and finding community. You're listening to A to Z Running. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the A to Z Running Podcast, where we help runners thrive. I'm Andy.
I am Zach.
And today on the A to Z Running Podcast, we're talking about fueling for the run, and we're going to get into some research and really dive into why this is such a complicated subject.
Three particular things that you want to think about while we discuss this shortly: how to train your body to metabolize stored fuel, and why the way we do that matters. Fueling choices ought to be more closely related to the nature of our training. And finally, it's possible that there may be some guiding considerations for the best sort of diet for runners. Oh yeah, I said it.
Oh man.
And you definitely want to know all of that and more, but you can't unless you go to atozrunning.com and click the word follow. Actually, I just lied, because you can if you just keep listening. However, we'd love it if you first went to atozrunning.com, click the word follow, go to YouTube, go to all of the social media places and podcast platforms, and click subscribe. And anywhere that there's a notification, ring that bell so that you don't have to come find us, and we can deliver our content directly to you and your ears or eyes, or we could skip both and just go straight to your brain if you'd like it.
Oh, wow. That seems advanced. Well, we love connecting with you, and thank you so much to those of you who have subscribed and become part of the conversation. Margs and Marathons, you've heard her name before, and she's been on the show, and she's also had a lot of great interactions with us. She asked our most recent podcast guest, Dr. Todd Buckingham, a specific question about last week's episode, which was all about the science of building fitness. And she asked this, or she said this: love this episode. I have a question I would love answered by Dr. Todd. What effects does cycling and bike training have on run performance? In your experience, Todd, do triathletes and duathletes gain benefits in the run times from extra aerobic volume that they do during these other activities? And Todd's answer was great. He says, great question. Research has shown that aerobic benefits of cycling or swim training can have positive impacts on cardiovascular endurance for running. Swimming and cycling can also be a great way to maintain cardiovascular fitness without the increased stress that running has on the lower body because of its weight-bearing nature. This is one of the reasons why professional runners or those who do high mileage will opt to swim or bike for some of their training. However, there are specific adaptations that the body goes through while running that they do not go through when swimming or cycling. One that I mentioned is that running is weight-bearing, while the other two are not. Another is the efficiency of running and your running form are not transferred between cycling and swimming.
One of the big lessons here in Todd's response, thank you, Todd, for responding, is that time matters. How much time do you have available? Because for most of us, being that our time is limited and we're trying to gain the most possible benefits from our activities, if you are a runner with running performance goals, chances are you should be spending the most, if not all of your time in running, as opposed to adding cross training in replace of running. And the reason is not for everyone, because if you're struggling with health issues or if you need some alleviation from that weight bearing stuff, then these cross training options are good alternatives.
Or if you're multi-talented and you actually do those other sports.
Well, there are certainly people out there who do that.
Like Ann and Todd.
But my point is not that. My point is, if you're a runner and you're looking to improve your running goals, your running performance, then for most of us, the answer is as much running as we healthily can maintain is probably the right mix, because we're not able to spend 2-3 hours a day training because we're not professionals for most of us. So, and that's where Todd's answer is especially helpful, because these things can have benefits, but they're not going to have the degree of benefit that a run in its stead would for runners.
But again, that's saying too, like, if you are down, if you are injured, you should do these exercises because we want to make those gains. Like we mentioned on the podcast, there are gains that can be made for this aerobic, this cardiovascular fitness that can last you for years. So you want to remain consistent. These are great opportunities to maintain and increase that fitness.
Well, as it happens, whether you're swimming, cycling, or running, you're spending at least some amount of time sore. And what better way to alleviate some of that soreness than with Roll Recovery's products like the customizable R8. Mm-hmm. And you can check out all of these recovery products at rollrecovery.com, where you can also build your own R8. Pretty fancy stuff there. Mm-hmm. However, if you're not yet convinced, because I haven't said the word recovery enough, then let's go ahead and jump back into our conversation with Lewis Falland of Roll Recovery. You recall we've had him on a few times now, sharing some snippets of advice and ideas and insights for all of us. This time, we want to hear Lewis talk a little bit more about why recovery matters.
So why should runners care about recovery products, like those that haven't used them before? And what does the research say to support that?
Yeah. So like I said, I mean, that gap is kind of what we wanted to fill between the pros who get these intense massages and recovery techniques, and then people who just don't have as much access to that. So it's kind of a do it at home thing. So people have known and people have said for a really long time now, and I'm sure you guys have heard it as well, that recovery is the majority of the game when it comes to specifically running, but you know, a bunch of other sports too. The best in the world will say that over and over and over again. It's like 80% of the game is, you know, taking care of the muscles that you just blasted to pieces, getting enough sleep, and then, you know, feeding yourself correctly and hydrating and all those things, you know. So the research definitely, it definitely backs this through and through. We'll talk a little bit more about like deep tissue massage specifically, which is what our products are meant to do. But the market now has caught on to the fact that recovery is a huge thing. So it's easy to get overwhelmed with all the products out there. I know I have been in the past. You got, you know, like the percussion guns, you have like vibrating foam rollers now, you got massage chairs, you got just like your regular foam rolling, and then the billion variations of that. These are all designed to make you kind of like feel better in the moment. But Jeremy and Adriana's goal was to create something that actually got to the root of the issue. And the way that they did that was by developing this product that got deeper than anything else on the market. That's kind of what separates us. And from there, the science, it turns out, just kind of like backed that up as we went. And then for sure, like experiences that people had personally certainly backed that up as well.
Thanks again, Lewis. Now, for all the rest of you, head to rollrecovery.com to check out all of those recovery products. Now, let's take a look at some of the latest from the world of running.
We are going to start off the world of running with some very exciting news.
The best.
The best news. The world's best 10K, in fact. Sifan Hassan broke the world record in the Netherlands at the FBK Games in a blistering 29.06.
10,000 meters on the track in 29.06.
She bested the previous by 11 seconds.
Wow.
Which before then was like 14 seconds faster than the previous time. So you can imagine how excited and elated she was. In fact, there was a picture that I put in my stories. I'll put it in there again, of her just elated at the finish line. And she was doing this almost entirely alone.
Yeah, pretty much. You got to call that one alone. She had pacers. They didn't make it very long.
Or 2K.
Just a little over a mile. Not
wow.
great.
Wow. Wow. So her 5Ks, Zach, were 14:38 and then negative splitting in 14:28.
Yeah. That's
These
what
are
she did.
World-class 5K times. These would win.
As a matter of fact, she is the world leader in the 5K right now in 14:35. And she just ran faster than that in her second
in her 5K. Closing 5K. What?
Yeah.
That was an impressive.
There are a lot of things that go through my mind when you see things like this. Certainly, just more than anything else, we know that Sifan Hassan is a danger in any distance-related event, even mm-hmm. middle distance. I mean, she's run 156 in the 800. Like, fast. So she's the one who did the 1500, 10,000 meter double at the 2019 World Championships, winning them both gold. I don't think anyone else has done that. I have to go back and look again, but so that's crazy. And then she also holds the European record in the half marathon in just a shade over 65 minutes. Mm. So basically, if you line up in a race with Sifan Hassan and it's a championship level event, you're pretty much just shaking and terrified.
Trembling in your boots.
Trembling.
Yeah. Well, she has now made the history books running this amazing time. I mean, she already has before, but this was an especially difficult record to beat.
It is fascinating. I just want to reflect one more time on the nature of her career, because she also holds the world record in the indoor mile. And I don't know how many people have held the mile and 10,000 meter record at the same time. This is incredible. So fun to watch. She'll be at the Olympics. You can rest assured, unless she gets hurt, but she'll be there. And the question everyone's wondering is, what events does she do? It's certainly going to be plural. There's no way she does just one, but which plurality? And then just going to be exciting to watch. So we'll keep you updated certainly on that. Let's jump to Saturday, June 5th. And this was in Birmingham, England, the European 10,000 meter cup, which I haven't paid a lot of attention to this event in the past. And now I'm realizing that it's because it's kind of obscure, and that makes these things very interesting to me. So why it's kind of obscure is because it's both a European championship race, kind of. It's not a meet. It's just one race on the track, the 10,000 meters, and it's the European Cup, but it was also the British Olympic trials at the same time. So you have the Brits in the race running basically against each other, and still trying to run the race against everyone else as well. And so you have two races happening at once. And I always find that to be interesting, fascinating. Well, as you can guess, it was exciting. And let's jump to the women first, because it was Eilish McColgan of Britain who won the event overall. So the European Cup title, as well as the British Trials title, because she's also British. She ran a stellar 31:19. Not a PR for her, but a well-executed race. As a matter of fact, it was somewhere around 1K to go, where the leader, which let me jump down here to get the name, Selma Mowet Teferi of Israel, was winning the race by over 15 seconds one point. She had a huge lead. And Eilish McColgan reeled her in over the course of the last, well, it was basically the last 600 meters. And if you picture this, with a lap and a half to go, she was more than a full straightaway behind Teferi. So like she couldn't even see her on the same straightaway. That's really far behind on a track.
Those races are always like super exciting and almost mesmerizing.
To watch just the gap like, slowly.
Yeah, to see the reeling happen. It's like, wow.
So that kind of thing. Yeah, it was one to watch for that reason. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just McColgan who was reeling in Teferi either. She was actually just kind of leading the charge, specifically with countrywoman Jessica Judd, who also finished very close behind. So what it ended up being was between the three of them, they were like a second plus a few tenths apart in the finish. And it was McColgan for the win. It was Teferi in second, which was also an Olympic qualifying time. So that's Teferi's stamp to the Olympic Games, because she did not have the time previously. And she'll be representing Israel then. And then Britain's Jessica Judd finished in third, just a shade behind in 31:20, which was also her first time running under the Olympic standard for the 10,000 meters. So that, by the way, was a 31:25, that standard.
Okay.
And Judd has it as well in the 5K. So we'll see the British track trials for the rest of all the events happen later in June.
It was separate for the 10,000.
Separate for the 10,000, which again is part of what made this an intriguing experience. But so we'll see Jessica Judd on the track again in the 5K. And I don't know, in a situation like what she's doing, I don't know what she would choose to do for the Olympics if she were to qualify in both. She's got a real chance at it though.
Mm. That's so cool.
So that's good. And I did want to just mention it was Luisa Gega of Albania who ran a new Albanian 10,000 meter record in this event. She finished in sixth place. She ran 32:16 and set a new national record. Very
exciting stuff. Now up for the men. The headline of this event has been about Mo. So Mo Farah did not actually make it on the Olympic squad. He hasn't hit the Olympic time. So everyone's talking about it because obviously he's, you know, an Olympian and one of the fastest. He's a legend. So what are your thoughts, Zach?
Well, it's always a little bit tedious to me when the headline for a championship event is about a person who didn't do well. And, you know, there were other people in the race who like won and stuff, and maybe it should just be about them. But anyway, so it's always tedious when we just make it all about the star who didn't, you know, kind of thing. But anyway, so yeah, Mo Farah did not run the time. He was second for the Brits, which means that if he were to get the time in the next few weeks, he could go to the Olympics in the 10K still. It's a very interesting thing because he's been talking like this is another 10K gold medal coming up here. That's what his goal has been, as it would be if you're a 10-time gold medalist at the world stage. But it's been some time. This is the 4 years since his last 10,000 meters on the track. That was the space there between that. And he was going to do the marathon, but that wasn't going well for him. So he thought, let me go back to what I know best. And now that didn't look great, but you got to give him some forgiveness because, you know, he ran 27:50, which is not slow. 27:28 is the Olympic standard. But, you know, 27:50 for what is essentially a 4 year rust buster.
Yeah.
I got to give that to him and just say, I'll wait and see. I'm not going to make any judgments now. But Mark Scott did take the British Trials crown in the event. He finished seventh overall, but first for the Brits, which is going to send him to the Games for sure because he's already got the time. He ran 27:10 back in February. Mark Scott, by the way, if you know the name from some of our other conversations, he trains in the U.S., runs with Bowerman Track Club, and will be in the Games, likely is going to qualify in more than one event. We'll see him again at the end of the month in the 5K probably. And he's got a good shot there too. So exciting stuff all around. Now, we did want to mention then, because we did talk about the winners of the race. Right. It was the British Trials, though, and he was the winner of the... Yeah, okay. So the winner of the European Cup, though, was France's Morhad Amdouni. And he ran 27:23 for an Olympic qualifying time as well. And then second place, Bashir Abdi of Belgium, also along with Carlos Mayo of Spain, ran Olympic standards, second and third place. So those three were all under the 27:28 solid performances right there.
Now in Portland, there's been some great races happening. The Stumptown Twilight occurred on Thursday, and we wanted to just highlight the 1,500-meter run because it was kind of interesting. Josh Kerr, he won in a time of 3:31, 4 seconds over the next competitor.
3:31 is fast.
It's very fast, and it's the fourth fastest 1500 on the U.S. soil.
That is the truth, and the second fastest in the world this year as well.
Yes.
So only behind Timothy Chariot of Kenya.
By himself. That's an incredible performance to not have like a race going on.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, Josh Kerr has been signaling with other things he's been doing in the last several months that he's in good shape and he's marching along. But that puts him kind of in that type of a position now. You know, you've got to be watching him for medal contention at the Games because not many people can run that fast.
So. No. And yeah, like I said, like he wasn't running against Timothy Chariot.
No. We'll see. Yeah, we'll see when he gets in the big race.
So in the second heat, this is also interesting. So in the second heat, there were two guys who didn't make it to the NCAAs who decided to run this meet and hit the Olympic trial standard. So, their season's not done. They've now extended their racing season. So from New Mexico, sophomore Abdizarik Abnaram, he ran a time of 3:37, and Oregon senior Jack Yerian. He also hit that qualifying mark.
3:37. So they had to run under 3:37:50, and they were both like a couple of tenths under, which is they snuck under.
They did it.
Good stuff. So just two other quick notable items. There was another national record, and this time it was in the women's steeplechase for Netherlands. 3,000-meter steeplechase record of 9:27 going to Irene van der Rijken. And then there was as well a new Pennsylvania high school 1600-meter record for the boys. And we've been talking about some of the high school records this year because it just is fascinating to me that high school records are just starting to drop all over the place, especially at these different state records. This one in particular, though, was a 39-year-old record. and it was just broken by Gary Martin, running a 1600 meter time of 4:03. Not bad at all.
Solid stuff.
Well, certainly more coming next week with the NCAA championships.
Yes. Oh, I did want to mention Hobbs Kessler. He ran here in Michigan for state meet, and he closed his 4x8 and just missed out running down their competitor by like 0.3 seconds. But what was that final time?
He ran 1:47. Okay, there's a dispute on exactly how fast his split was because it's a relay time, split. Yeah. But 1:47, certainly in some kind of change.
Hunting someone down.
That's fast.
Yeah, and perhaps to the kid who held him off.
Yeah, right. Hey, Hobbs Kessler's about to run over you. Yeah, okay. So that was good. He also won the title in the 1600 meter.
Oh, really?
In a slow 4:16. Actually, a lot of people were kind of like making jokes because, you know, with sports betting and stuff, there's probably some way to have bet on that race. And it's like, if only I would have bet that Hobbs Kessler was going to run slow, I could have made so much money.
You would have guessed that too, though. You would have guessed.
Yes,
he would have run just to win.
Because he's not going to go out and run. Well,
he's
going
to run
to
win.
Sometimes they go out and try to break records.
Oh, sure.
They do that sometimes.
But he already got it.
But in this instance, he didn't. And that's okay. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll come back with more of that next week. So for this topic, in order to talk well about fueling and nutrition and such, we wanted to find some good sources to share with you initially. So you're going to want to do a little bit more reading on this after listening to us talk, because this is the kind of thing that we really can't talk through all the details, especially the science of some of this, and have it be compelling listening on air for the entire time. But what we can do is draw out some of the key notes and things that you're going to want to pay attention to, and then go read more is going to be our encouragement. So I'm going to share this article. This was posted on irunfar.com by a guest post from Corinne Malcolm, I believe is her name. And most importantly here, she cites a lot of studies. And so this is where it's always good to say, okay, how does this information play at the science level? And then why does that tell me something valuable about my running? That is where you'd want to start. And so I use her article because it's a really great synthesis of the fueling and what's happening inside our bodies, even down to a cellular level, as well as then what that means for training. So what we're going to do here is we're going to first break down the fueling and the science a little bit, and then we're going to give you three big takeaways for training and running and really try to make it make sense here. So I like talking about this kind of stuff. I don't always, as Andy likes to point out occasionally, I don't always make it clear what I'm trying to say. And part of it is because I don't fully understand the science, like at the molecular level, what happens when our body's like breaking down glucose and then, you know, the ATP stuff. I've read a bit about it so that I understand what's happening there, but I don't fully understand it. This is why you're going to want to go read these studies. What I can do is convey the big ideas behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So here are the main points. If I can try to break them down a bit for you here, we're trying to talk about how it, when we ingest fuel and it goes somewhere in our body, and then our activity, our run, needs to access that fuel, what's going on with that whole process there? So, first point, glycogen stores amount to something like up to 2,000 calories. So when you think about, okay, I'm eating stuff, and if the stuff is glucose glycogen based, like carbs, then I can store inside my body somewhere around, and it's not an exact number, it's different for different people, it's different for different reasons, but somewhere around up to 2,000 calories. And that is, as a result, fairly easy to access fuel, glycogen stores. Generally, it would last, if I'm doing kind of like a strong aerobic activity, it would last maybe 90 to 120 minutes. And that's all a very big maybe, because it depends on everything. Like weather matters there, how much you're wearing matters there. But you're also rarely ever running at full maximum storage. Right. So you're not at the full storage. You're at some
you
amount
depleted.
You didn't
eat depleted. The Pop-Tart at 2 a.m., okay?
Well, yeah. Like, did you top off your fuel stores enough in exactly the right increments? No, because you weren't trying to do that. There are people out there who have researched it enough to know exactly how to try to keep that fuel store at right at the top. Anyway, so that means 90 to about 120 minutes on just this glycogen stores. It's easier to burn, as I mentioned, and what the science tells us about that is basically it's something that your body can burn into ATP and a few other things quickly, and that's the stuff that your cells need then to produce energy, that ATP especially. And so as a result, with oxygen as a part of the process, so an aerobic activity, it's a fairly quick burn, but it also can go from aerobic to anaerobic. Glycogen can be burned in any energy, any energy system uses glycogen if it's available. And so because as a consequence, you can be in an aerobic activity burning glycogen and immediately go to anaerobic and continue burning the same fuel source, which is why you can make that jump so easily. It's not hard to go from aerobic to anaerobic, or at least it's hard, but it's not difficult for your body.
I think I know what you're saying. Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's the interesting thing about glycogen stores. Does not require oxygen, but it can use oxygen, so it's a fairly versatile fuel source, and it burns quickly, it burns easily, but because it burns quickly, it doesn't last terribly long, and the fuel stores themselves are very low. So I said 2,000 calories, and that initially, that's like, oh, that's a lot, right? How about this? Fat storage in your body can, and this is again a very big can, store up to something like 100,000 calories. Hmm. And that's not true for all people.
Yeah, exactly. It probably depends on like the size of person. Yes. Yep. And yeah,
the size. And, yeah, it depends on your body mass index, a few other things. Like there's a lot of factors that are just related and involved. I didn't go into much detail in my own research on that at this moment in my life. At some point, I'm certainly going to because I'm very curious about all of this. But the key takeaway here is your fat storage is significantly higher. Even for someone who's like, you know,
very lean,
super skinny, you still have higher fat storage content than glycogen storage content. And it's available to you as a fuel for running. However, there's some more caveats there. The first thing, I guess, is to say, you're as far as a runner, unless you're doing crazy ultra marathons, but like marathoners and even shorter ultra marathoners, you could burn fat storage the entire time, basically, and you're not going to run out of stored fat. So in terms of like the amount that's available to burn, it's nearly infinite in relative terms here.
At a certain pace.
Yes. And that's the key here. So it takes longer to burn it, which means you can't burn it as quickly. So you can't use it as quickly. So you have to be going slower. You have to be going easier so that your body isn't trying to burn it too quickly, because if it is, it immediately stops. It doesn't work. And so what we're talking about here then is it's aerobic because it has to have oxygen in order for your body to break down fat. And this is like where the science, so it's like glycolysis is breaking down glycogen, and then it's like lipolysis, I don't know how to say these words, is breaking down fat. And what that does is it uses oxygen. It cannot break down fat without oxygen. So as a result, you have to be in an aerobic state, and you can't be in too high of an aerobic state because it doesn't break down fast enough to supply the necessary energy. Okay, so this is the big difference between glycogen, carbohydrate heavy storages, and fat storages. Okay, now let's get into
your brain isn't like reeling right now.
Oh, but you're already starting to ask the question.
Yep, you're asking the question.
What does this have to do with my running? And you're already starting to think there are implications here. You're detecting them. Now just wait, because there's a big reveal coming. So, okay, for a normal person eating a normal diet, because this author, by the way, spends a lot of time discussing the different kinds of diets that relate to carbohydrate, protein, and fat intake. Mm-hmm. And that's fascinating. I did not try to go through much detail of her examination, but go read that article if you want to more.
Right, because we also don't want to get into any kind of conflicts with any of you.
I don't mind getting in conflicts with you.
I don't want
Andy
to.
Andy doesn't want to. But actually, I do have some things related to that later. Oh, Andy doesn't even know about it because I didn't share it with her yet. Okay, well, so for a normal person eating what we might call a normal thing to eat, at least in areas where we live, which means you're eating some carbohydrates, you're eating some protein, and you're eating some fat on a regular basis. That some amount, some combination, probably more carbohydrates than fats, probably somewhere in the middle for proteins. That's what I'm going to call normal. And that matters here because then there are extremes, obviously. But for the normal person, the body will be tuned to then utilizing, as you might guess, most readily carbohydrates. Because remember, glycogen burns more easily than fat. And so your body will burn carbohydrates, glycogen, more readily. And so if I'm eating a normal diet, that means I have plenty of carbohydrates available. That means my body's going to be burning that most likely. And it's not likely going to be trying to burn much else during my running activities unless it doesn't have the carbohydrates available. And I should mention, before your body ever gets to the stored fuel sources, it will first occupy things like the blood sugar that's available, because glycogen does flow within your cells and your blood at a very small amount. And so it'll first tap into that, and then it'll tap out really quickly, and then it'll move on to the stores. That also is going to matter for when we talk about race fueling.
Mm.
Yes.
That's why you need to stick around.
I'm dropping the hints. Okay, so get that out of the way. That's important. The body is not, by the way, naturally very effective at using fat stores unless you don't eat carbohydrates. Like, naturally, our bodies are just not going to be great at it. That matters because the body can and needs to, if you want to be able to use fat stores, can be conditioned to do so better. And this is one of the mind-blowing things for me as I'm reading through some of the research here, which is, and I can't remember the phrase that they keep using, there's some abbreviation with like MFO or something, but the point is you condition your body to burn fat as a primary fuel source, or at least as a good fuel source, and it's something that you can actually train and increase gradually over time so that it can become more efficient and it can do so at a better rate. So I mentioned that burning fat takes a longer time, and therefore you can't burn it too quickly, or you can't try to burn it too quickly, or it won't be available. But you can actually improve that. Your body can get better at metabolizing fat. That's interesting.
It
right?
is interesting.
But it doesn't if you only ever have lots of carbohydrates in your body.
So bagels all day, Zach.
Well, okay. That could be a detriment for me in this instance, but it's not going to necessarily. So this is a part where I definitely want you to go read the article to get the details, because I'm not going to try to break down the percentages, but it's a significant, like you can see a 20 to 25, 50% even increase in your body's ability to burn fat by conditioning it over time, by training it to do that. And that is where, and I, like Andy said, we're not going to try to spend a lot of time on this, but that is where the keto type of diets get that's their mantra, is that we can make your body great at burning fat so you don't need all those carbs, therefore it's a good diet, right? Not going to argue that point at this moment, but that's the point that the keto diet tries to live and die on, and it's absolutely true. And so what happens is you basically condition your body to burn fat better by doing one of two things. One, don't eat carbs. If you stop eating carbs, your body will find another way, and that will be predominantly in fats.
Well, I read this article and she said it wasn't a great idea to only eat fats.
Yep, that's true. We'll come back to why in a moment. But okay, the second way you can condition your body to only eat fats is, well, actually, you know what? Let's dwell on this for a moment, because otherwise I'm never going to come back to it. I'm going to forget. Why is the keto diet have some potential negative consequences? And it's simply the foremost because you can potentially ruin your body's ability then to use carbohydrates.
Well, and you'd have to be going slow all the time.
So if I do a fat-only diet for a protracted period of time, if it's just like briefly for a little bit, it's not going to make much of a difference. But for a significant period of time, then my body's going to gain its efficiency in burning fats at the cost of losing its ability to burn well carbohydrates. So then when you eat carbohydrates, and this is, we all know this, if I'm on a keto diet for 6 months and then I go and I eat a piece of cake, it doesn't feel good, it doesn't digest well, and it doesn't produce very helpful energy stores. As a matter of fact, it actually just converts to like dead weight really quickly in your body, and then your body doesn't know what to do with it. It's really rough. But that's, you know, that we understand that because the body is adaptable, and this is good. However, there's also some other surrounding ramifications for runners. And the first, as Andy said, is glycogen is our intensity fuel. So if I want to go hard, I need glycogen because fat can't be burned without oxygen. Remember how I said that earlier? So if I'm on a keto-only diet and I really eat almost no carbs or very little carbs, then when I go and I'm like, I'm going to go do a half an hour and I'm going to run hard, it's going to feel awful and it's probably not even going to work because your body can't burn fat without oxygen. So once you exceed the oxygen threshold, you know, like VO2 max, you have no fuel because you don't have any carbs in your system. It's brutal. Okay, so that's not a good thing. There's also some emerging research, and I share this with a very heavy caveat. I know nothing about this field, and I'm only sharing because this author pointed to a study that clearly indicates this research, but there's not a lot of study on it. So there's some emerging research that there is a connection between high-fat, low-carb diets and bone problems.
Oh.
Predominantly in similar symptoms to osteopenia and osteoporosis types of things. So it's just a reduction in bone density. Now, interestingly enough, that makes total sense to me. And I don't know, the research didn't point at this because this wasn't part of the scope of their study, but it makes total sense to me because as a runner, when you do these hard activities, it's not just the direct fuel source that your body's utilizing. It's also utilizing micronutrients in a lot of complex ways. And one of those is your muscles need calcium to work hard, okay? They need it. And if you're not replenishing it well, then it goes to your bones for it. And as you can probably guess, a keto diet is harder to consume calcium without carbs, because calcium is often present in various complex carbohydrate foods, whereas it is not as often present in
like dairy,
high
though.
Fatty foods. Right. But how much dairy are you consuming? So like you see a trend there where the body seems to be having utilizing bone health in a negative way with those. So I don't know why. That was my speculation. But the study, and there's not much on it. There's not a lot of study on it, but seems to point in that direction. So that's a possible concern, just something to watch. In my opinion right now, it's not a confirmed thing, something to watch. So yeah, a lot there. And the reason why I wanted to do that, all of that, is to say there's another way. There's a second way to train our body to use fat as fuel, and that is in our running training more specifically, and in doing so in a few different possible ways within our running. And the nature of this is basically if you deplete all of your carbohydrate stores, then your body's going to look somewhere else for fuel. And as long as you're in an aerobic state using oxygen, your body can break down those fats. If you've never done that before, if your body has only ever tried to burn carbohydrates, and you probably don't even know if that's true, but if you have not trained your fat burning systems, you need to be at a very low intensity aerobic effort. Because even if you're within the aerobic range, but you're at a higher intensity aerobic effort, your body's still not going to be able to work well with those fats. And so we need to be at a very easy type of pace, and we need to have our carbohydrate stores depleted, our glycogen stores depleted. And when we do that, our body starts to say, hey, there's this fat, I can do that. Now, you can do that in a couple of different ways, but one of the easiest is fasted state running.
I've never done this.
Right. But the cyclists have been onto this for years, and runners just tend to be either or with this kind of thing. Either runners do know about it and do it on purpose or
don't. Or it's not worth the risk to them because you could get injured.
Potentially. And that's where how you approach it and with what care. So the main thing is if you're doing a fasted state run, keep it low intensity. Because the higher the intensity, the more your body's trying to use fuel sources because you need oxygen, right, to burn fat. And so you got to keep it low intensity. Also, the amount of time you spend at a fasted state run matters because the longer you spend, the harder it is for your body and the longer recovery time you need. And that's where the risk of injury comes in, is you do a really long fasted state run and it takes a little bit longer for your body to recover fully. Why? Because it has to replenish more of those stores in addition to repairing some of the cellular level micronutrient types of things. But so it's going to take longer to recover. It's largely not an issue as long as your run is, let's just throw a ballpark, like under 90 minutes probably is no big deal. As long as you ate, a substantial dinner the day before kind of thing. You were eating.
I could not, with my smaller body, could not do a 90-minute run fasted without feeling ramifications.
And the main reason is because Andy's body's not great at burning fat.
I don't know. I've never bonked in a marathon, so.
Oh, that hurts. That was a direct attack on me because I've bonked in every marathon.
No, I'm not. I'm not trying to be prideful. But.
No, and actually, I haven't bonked in every marathon, but I have felt badly at the end of every. Okay, so. Yeah, there's a nuance there. But the main thing is if you're going to do fasted state runs, keep them shorter, keep them easy. And then the second way, and this is our recommendation, by the way, we do not advise our athletes to do fasted state runs as a general rule. We don't tell everyone to do that. But what we do advise our athletes to do is the depleted state long run. And this is when you essentially you need to just run long enough that you deplete your available energy stores so that your body starts working into the fat stores. And in doing so, you need to run easy enough that it's actually going to be able to tap into that energy. And then over time, as you do that regularly and often, like I suggest that for all of our runners, every long run is this kind of really easy long run. And it's not a fasted state run. I didn't say that. No, because it's too long. Yeah, it's too long to be a fasted state run. But instead, so you run long, you run easy, and your body's going to be able to tap into those fat stores. And then over time, it's going to get better and better at it so that you'll actually find you can run faster and harder while still using fat stores and not glycogen alone. And that is the miracle of this entire reflection, is that there's a way to make our bodies good at this so that we get to the point where we can do things like in a marathon race, utilizing fat stores for fuel is possible. And that is how you prevent your body from bonking at the end of a marathon based off of energy stores and metabolism.
So if there are any nutritionists listening who want to give us any feedback about this information, feel free to do so. We would love to hear from you about it because we do want to have discussions about this research and what we can do best as runners in order to fuel properly for our runs and our races.
So here's my big synthesis then for the big takeaways for runners as we reflect on all of that stuff. And I agree with Andy. Yeah, we probably need other people of expertise to help continue to advise these things because I don't claim to be an expert on it. I do know everything though. So the first big idea is as mentioned, long distance runners, especially marathoners, and even if you're not running as long as a marathon, the benefits here are quite clear in terms of our training. But long distance runners who never train the body to use fat efficiently have a hard time completing a long race without bonking. Because right. You will run out of glycogen stores. And then the most important thing to remember about these stored fuels is that it takes a long time to replenish them. And I do not have that number for you at the moment because I spent a while digging for it and I'm having a hard time finding exactness here. But the point is, if you're running 2-3-4 hour race, your body's not replenishing its stored energy in just a couple of hours. It's not doing it. It takes longer than that for the whole cycle and such. And you're getting some benefit from what you're consuming during the race, but most of it is via the blood sugar rise. So when you take like a gel or a goo in a race, it's influencing your blood sugar fairly quickly, and then you can tap into that. Your body can use those fuel sources immediately. But it's not entering into storage and then coming back out of storage as more fuel, not substantially. So as a result, we need to be able to do something beyond the 2,000 calorie limit that our glycogen stores give us. And that's the key factor there with that big takeaway. By the way, this is just another reminder that this is why in the training, why it's so important to keep the long runs easy early on, is because otherwise we just end up having this bad experience every time because we get to the end of our glycogen stores and we're going too hard. And then we can't really use the fat and then we don't ever improve it and it's rough. Some of Hansen's published work, by the way, on how long runs are potentially damaging to things like mitochondria is tied to this idea. I'm not going to go into any more depth of it right now because we didn't really prepare to try to address that in this moment, but that's where that connection comes in. So big idea number two, fueling strategies both before and during training and racing efforts should be informed and intentional based on the goal. And that's the whole point of if I'm getting ready to do an intense session, I need to eat something or I need to have fuel in me for that session because intensity requires glycogen at high levels especially. And so rule number one, if it's a hard effort, make sure you're well fueled for it. Don't try to do hard efforts in fasted states. It's just not good for you, and it also doesn't feel good.
Right.
And then the second part is if it's an easy effort and it's not any kind of extreme, I'm not doing like really long stuff, that's an opportunity for something like a fasted run if that's a way that I want to try to exercise this kind of fat burning dynamic. But one of the interesting things about the combination here is people try to do fasted state runs for things like weight loss, and there's a lot of question around whether that's actually an effective way to lose weight, knowing that a shorter, higher intensity effort without being fasted burns more calories. So remember I said that you burn fat slower than you burn glycogen? Substantially slower, in fact. And so you burn way more calories at an intense type of workout than you do at a lower intensity workout. So in order to gain the same amount of caloric burn, you have to go substantially longer in a fasted state run than you do in a short intense bout. But very few of us are using our workouts only for caloric burn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, in general, there's a lot more. So if weight loss is my goal, there's a lot more nuance that I want to be addressing, which I actually will share a couple of quick thoughts in a moment about that.
And I do want to say, because I was reading these articles too, that one of the things that Corinne was writing about was that every person does have obviously different needs and different usage of these macronutrients. And so there are there's a lot more nuance. There's digestive issues that people can have with carbs or fats, you know. So yeah, taking all these things into consideration, we're just giving you what the research is saying.
And on that note, let's address fueling during a run for a moment. So fueling during training versus fueling during racing is always a fascinating conversation. I do not understand why people fuel during training runs at a substantial level. Like, it seems to me that the only reason you would want to do that is to practice fueling for a race. And the main reason is simply because of all of what we've addressed here.
I'm going to play devil's advocate.
Not yet, Andy, but you can in a moment. If I know that the goal of training is to prepare my body for the race as best as possible, and I know that as a long-distance runner, so you shouldn't be fueling during training unless you're a long-distance runner, because you're probably not training so long that you need to take in fuel. Maybe that's a different conversation. But the point is, fueling during the training run is going to change the nature of how my body is accessing fuel during the run. And so, as mentioned, if I want to train the fat storage access, I can't take in sugars while I'm running, or my body's just going to continue using the glycogen that I'm taking in while I'm running. And so in that instance, you're handicapping yourself for your ultimate goal if your ultimate goal is a longer distance race. But I know that many runners do it because the research shows you recover faster, right?
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Do you know why? Do you know why you recover faster? Because, one, you're probably going at too high of an intensity.
Why does that make you recover faster?
No. When you try to access those fat stores, if you're at too high of an intensity, it can't effectively use them, and therefore you have no fuel left, and you're causing some destructive, this is where the Hansen's thing comes in, you're causing some destructive elements that take longer to recover than if you take that fuel during the run. Your body doesn't ever have to use the fat stores, which means at that higher intensity. So the main point here is, if you need to take fuel on your training, on your long runs, because otherwise you like say, well, I feel like I can't do it if I don't take the fuel, my answer to you is very simple. Slow down. You're handicapping yourself by doing that. You need to train those systems to be able to do their job well, because they have to do it when you're in the race situation. You cannot take in enough goos and gels on a marathon or longer race to substantially sustain you throughout the entire run. Your body needs to be able to use its fuel sources better than that. And so don't do it is the point. To that point. However, there are other instances. I agree. There are other instances when you would want to and you would. And certainly one of the most important of them being, you definitely need to practice your fueling stuff before your race. You never want your race to be the first time you try that goo, or the first time you try to eat a peanut butter and jelly while you're on a bike, or wait, that's something different. But definitely worth practicing it, but not all the time. And this is where I'm going to have a slight caveat. There's a Runner's World article about depletion long runs, right? Which is the concept that I've been addressing here. And Runner's World gives a little bit of a nod to this depletion long run concept. And they say, you know, exactly what basically I just said. It's a good way to train your body to metabolize fat and do so over time. And then at the very end of the article, they just slide this right in there and they say, but you should only do this occasionally. And my mind erupted when I read that. Because guess what? If you only do this occasionally, your body will never sustain the adaptations and it won't ever get any better. So all you're doing is wasting your time by depletion long running once in a while.
How do you really feel about it, Zach? How do you really feel?
I don't even get that. That's like saying basically like, you know, as a runner, you should do long runs, but don't do them much, like once a month or so. It's like, that's great, except not.
I think the reason that there is like so much conversation surrounding this topic and, you know, even these more depleted long runs is because as distance runners, we often walk a tightrope in some ways. And so like we don't want to get injured. And so like sometimes it's like, you know, I don't want to tell somebody to do this because there's a possibility that they're going to do it wrong and run too fast and then get hurt.
Okay. I will tell you how to do it right now. That's great, Andy. Thank you for reminding me to tell everyone how to do it right. Okay, so in conditioning, when you're in the early stages of your training cycle, all depletion long runs, no fuel during your long runs, certainly eat a breakfast. I mean, eat before the run because you want to be going long.
And how long are these long runs?
Well, so you need total depletion. The whole point of the long run in this phase is to achieve total depletion so that you can teach your body to use those aerobic stores. So 2 to 2.5 to 3 hours for almost all of us is what it's going to take to do that. But level of intensity matters as well because they have to be easy. And so then as a consequence, it takes longer to reach total depletion, which is why you need this longer run. Okay. You get the puzzle pieces all fitting together now, right? This is a perfect puzzle. So you got to run it slow because otherwise your body can't use the fat well. And you have to run it long enough that your body can deplete all the glycogen stores and then can access the fat. Now, someone smart out there is going to say, well, why don't you just run really hard for a little while? Burn all that glycogen and then just run slow for another hour or something. And my answer to you is, I don't think it works that way. Even if it does work that way, that's really not great training for the long goal, which is, you know, you need the time on feet as well. So there is another benefit to it, which is you're building your leg strength also while you're doing this. So I need you to be running a little bit longer long run. Don't just try to cheat or game the system there. However, that's also why you need to keep it slow, is so that you can achieve the use of fats with oxygen. So you keep it slow, you keep it long, and you don't mess around with fueling during the run, and you don't mess around with any of that progressive long run stuff. That has no place in a conditioning early stages of a training cycle. However, as Arthur Lydiard argued, among many others, but he was probably the first, and he did it before anyone knew this science, there's a time later in your training when your body has now built up its capacity to burn fat at higher and higher intensities, because as I said, that grows, and it actually can grow substantially over time, not the runner's world method, which is occasional, but regular long runs, depletion long runs. So you build it up over time, and then you're able to actually run at a fairly high aerobic intensity while still burning those fats. And that's when you really get the money long runs, when you have the opportunity to do things like harder long runs. You could go the progressive route. Lydiard argued against progressive long runs himself, largely because that's a recipe for overdoing it by accident. It's certainly a recipe for putting yourself too close to the line. He would have his athletes, and I think this is probably a better approach in general here, is just run the entire run at a little bit more elevated state. And so if your long run,
steady state?
No, not fully, but closer. So if your long runs were something like, you know, 9 minute pace at very easy, that was your very easy long run during conditioning, then later in these stages, you might be running your long runs at like 8 or 8:30 pace. So it's not substantially faster, but it's faster, and it's still maximizing your body's capacity to burn those fat stores, as well as elevating some of the training components that you want late in the stages before the race. There, I just told you the right way to do it. So now you know in training, there's a reason for these certain things at certain times. And I probably didn't mention it because there was a big idea number three, and that has to do with our diets. And after reading through this entire article, and I appreciated the author, Corinne, she did give kind of like a, here's my take then on the right way to do the diet thing for runners. And it really has everything to do with the balance matters here, because we want our body to have the carbohydrates. We want it to have the fats, and you got to have the protein, but it's not necessarily the fuel sources you're using during the run. But anyway, so we got to have these balanced types of diets if we can. Obviously, not everyone can access the diet in the same way as everyone else. But the point here being that balanced dynamic is likely the most effective way to be able to train well, to try to perform well within the fueling strategy. So she mentioned that there's some kind of method around, like a lot of people do periodic shifts in diets. So it's like I do one diet for a week or one diet for a week, and, you know, back and forth, so that you don't lose any of the elements, but you sustain certain ones for a little bit longer. She said that that's one way you can do a balanced approach still. It's just kind of a little bit harder to navigate for most of us.
It would be hard for me.
Would be. It would be. But the point being, glycogen alone doesn't cut it, but no glycogen, no carbs doesn't cut it. And always remembering that the foundational aspect that we always want to answer is, why do we eat? To fuel.
And for pleasure, and for community, and culture.
I don't know. So anyway, there may be a long list of reasons why you want to eat. But what fundamentally, as animals...
Like, what do we need?
Why are we eating? Because we must have fuel. So then the question we should be answering is, how should I fuel best? And these are considerations that should be on your mind.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't planning on plugging this, but I'm going to. So Chelsea of May's Menu, it has a really great cookbook, and I'm going to link to it.
It is a good one.
Yeah, yeah. So some of our favorite recipes have come from that. And just thinking through, like, getting these great macronutrients, it would be a great resource. So I'll link to that.
And that's a good point, Andy, is like, so I know what I need to eat, but how do I make it still taste good? And how do I make it still, you know, a good balance of things with good ingredients and stuff? That's why it's so helpful to have things like Chelsea's cookbook.
Yeah.
Just makes it a little bit easier.
Uh-huh.
Very nice. So I did mention that we were going to just briefly touch on weight loss. So if my goal is not performance at the moment, but my priority is weight loss, then I do address these things differently. I think about this kind of thing differently. And I think the big three things that I'm going to mention here is that you always need to be thinking about how you can teach your body to sustain the trajectory you're on. It's not just about doing extreme measures to cut weight for the next 2 weeks, because that's not sustainable types of stuff. So Megan Featherston...
injured.
Yes. And Megan Featherston gave us the advice when she was on our show, where she said, you know, the best approach, especially for long-term progress here, is to just look at the total fuel storage and just under fuel a tiny bit.
Skim off the top, is how she put it. Skim off the top.
And I really like that mindset. And so if we think of it in terms of these really tangible things, like I can store 2,000 calories of glycogen in my body. So when I refuel, I fill it up to 1800, or maybe you're storing 1800, because obviously that's not an exact number. So don't take my cue and say, oh, I should base off 2000. That's a very generalized thing. So whatever the total number is, I take it down a little notch. And then I just try to do that every day. And I certainly don't, I can't find success with that kind of a thing if I'm doing like extreme, you know, if I'm bouncing around where it's like for a couple of days I was on it and then the next day it was like 500 calories over. Like, so don't get too obsessed with those numbers, but think about how I can be even with the approach to it is always good. And the other thing is, you can do two things really well for yourself as an athlete to try to help with a weight loss goal. One of them is muscle mass burns calories better, like higher muscle mass burns calories better. And so our metabolism has a lot to do with our muscles. And if I can build muscle a little bit, I can burn calories more effectively when I'm not working out as well. And so it's not a bad idea, and I highly recommend it for anyone who is working on this and have the, like, you feel like you're hitting kind of a wall and it's just not going super well. Hit the weight room for like 3 weeks, and don't do anything crazy, but hit the weight room for like 3 weeks and do the high weight, low rep types of situations with plenty of rest between the segments, because you don't want to blow your muscles out. You just want to be able to build a little bit of these muscle fibers. So you gain a few more muscle fibers, and it's going to benefit you throughout the day. And that's a good way to pair with the balanced approach to have kind of a little bit of extra help.
So another great way is to, you know, talk to a sports nutritionist. So we'll link to Megan Featherston, that episode that we had with her, but also her information.
It's good stuff. Well, we just basically tried to throw at you everything you should want to know about fueling as a runner, or at least everything that's on our mind at this exact moment. Just remember the big ideas, right? Train your body to use fat, and you'll be glad you did. Be smart about how your fueling and training interact with each other, and make your choice based off of what your training needs, not just, you know, this sounds like a good idea today, or I didn't have enough time, and so I didn't eat anything before my 8x800 interval workout. And three, balance the diet to support quality training and performance.
And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your experiences. And if you would like a coach, if you're looking for a coach, we have a few more openings. So please contact us. You can find our training support at a2crunning.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.